continue, counsel.
Prior to the noon break, there was reference made on page 87 of the appendix to remarks in question 21 by the trial judge in his report, in which he checked no after the phrase, was the victim physically harmed or tortured? And then he adds on, if yes, state the extent of harm or torture, excluding the actual murder of the two victims. Now, that's what the trial judge thought in his mind. It's his reflection. He qualifies it saying there's definitely physical harm to the victims. And I think the record more than adequately establishes that by virtue of the nature of the wounds to these two victims. We have argued and still consistently maintain that the Supreme Court of Georgia, when it conducts its review, as mandated by our General Assembly, carefully goes over the facts to make sure that they're supported by a reasonable doubt, compares them with similar cases, and then also looks to determine whether or not there's been any arbitrariness or discrimination or prejudice in the case. We've had the argument by petitioner that B7, the seventh aggravating circumstance, is a catch-all. And yet we've had language by our court in Harris, which looked for guidance from the Dixon case, that we're going to look at the essential, the hardcore, the gruesome type of execution type slayings.
Well, what would you say if in the case of the clean, so-called clean rifle shot to the heart, just bang, and the prosecutor nevertheless relies on seven as an aggravating circumstance, and the jury comes back and finds it.
All right.
Would you say that and there's an Eighth Amendment challenge to that in the sense that if the seventh aggravating circumstance can cover this, it can cover anything.
All right.
And so you're back to unruled discretion.
No, I don't think we are, Justice White, and this is why I say we're not. I don't think the outcome would be any different as far as you're saying unruly discretion, because if that individual pre-plans that execution, and let's say that he does it with a single-shot rifle and stands on the top of a building and waits for his victim to come to work and picks him off.
Well, you're just want to change my example. I'll posit any set of circumstances that you would require to say that Section 7 shouldn't reach it, but nevertheless it is relied upon and the jury finds it. And it's affirmed. What should we do about it?
When you say it's affirmed, you're talking
by the Supreme Court.
I think it depends on the facts in the case. And what I'm saying is you need to look at it. Does it fit within the mold of the other cases, similar cases which have arisen? And if it does,
what if it doesn't?
If it doesn't, then you ought to reverse it.
On what ground?
Well,
What would we say that the seventh aggravating circumstance is unconstitutional as applied in this case?
I would say that's probably what you would say because it doesn't fit in the similarity. Now, the similarity goes to.
Or would we have to say that? Well, this is a construction of this section by the Supreme Court of the state, and it reaches this far, and therefore it could reach that far in any case, and it's void on its face.
But I don't think we have to get that far because I think in their review to date, they have all of the cases which have come before it have been horrible crimes.
But how about this one?
I think this is as horrible and maybe not more horrible than others that haven't. But the only reason it's here is because it's such a horrible crime.
Well, maybe just the reverse. You didn't petition for cert.
That's correct.
It may be here because we think it isn't as horrible as others.
that's a possibility. But I think
what we do if we happen to disagree with you and think that on the facts of this case, this is way out of line with what the Georgia Supreme Court has done in other cases. Let's just suppose that.
All right. As I read the question posed in this case, if you disagreed that this case, the infliction of the death penalty, was not outrageously, wantonly, and vile, then what you would...
Well, we have to accept that it was and it is within the meaning of that seventh circumstance as construed by the Supreme Court.
That's correct.
Of the state. We just have to say that.
All right.
That this does fit within that meaning, and therefore, what should we do?
If you say it does fit within that meaning,
well, we have to accept
that. Right, and if it fits within that meaning, then you should affirm on the basis of the facts presented in the case. If I understand you, your question correctly, but if you assume that the Supreme Court of Georgia is correct, the facts show conduct which is outrageously and wantonly and vile, and that they have not too broadly construed what is an outrageous, a wanton, and a vile, an inhuman killing.
Well, that's the question. That's right. The question for Eighth Amendment purposes, I suppose.
I think it.
We can't say that they misconstrued their statute.
I agree with you.
We can't say that. They're in charge of construing the statute.
That's correct.
And these facts, whatever they are, we have to accept as being deemed outrageously wanton or vile by the Supreme Court of Georgia.
I don't think we have an Eighth Amendment problem, because I think the facts show...
No, you don't, but that's the question that was posed to be argued here.
Well, our position is we don't have an Eighth Amendment position or an argument against it in this aspect, because this is a crime which comes down in its well-defined set of circumstances, controlled discretion in the statute, appellate review, channeling, making sure that the jury doesn't go off on some tangent, within the state's right to prescribe the death penalty for certain standards of conduct, particularly where the defendant from the beginning has engaged in that course of conduct where he intends from the outset to take the victim's life, differing from the fact that he goes in, he robs a store, and he says, gee, this guy might be able to identify me. So at that point, here we have, before he even gets to his intended victim, the intent.
About the way the Georgia court construes the statute, are the words in that and involve torture, depravity of mind, and aggravated battery still part of the essential definition of this aggravated circumstance in your judgment?
No, I think, and the way they have construed it in Harris, they said, we view the words outrageously, wantonly, vile as applying to the conduct of the defendant, his act,
right,
and also as its impact upon the victim, which is illustrated or exemplified by either torture, aggravated battery, or depravity of mind.
You regard those as illustrative words rather than limiting words.
That's correct.
And, of course, when the court in the Gregg case considered the statute, I think the court assumed that those were limiting words. Wouldn't that be? I don't know if we really had to reach that.
You didn't reach it, yeah. and I would be speculating if I knew.
But they really are almost, we should then construe the statute just as though those words were not in it at all. And if that's true, then I suppose the bloody character of the shotgun killing could make it vile.
I think there's no question about it.
So you would rely on the fact it was a shotgun rather than a rifle to justify the finding of vile?
No question. He had the choice between the weapons, and I think the vileness is shown. He picked the weapon which would do the greatest damage because it blew both their heads off or literally reduced them to a pulp.
But so that we really, it's just a question of whether, then the question is a matter of the constitutional problem is whether a statute which just in broad language says any murder, rape, armed robbery, or kidnapping that's outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman, period,
is enough to be an aggravated circumstance.
That would be correct. And I say that it would, because those words are sufficient enough to put a defendant on notice as to what conduct is to be defended against. And there are also words from...
I don't know how they put them on notice if you say they're just illustrative and you say, well, anything else somewhat similar is also going to be charged.
Well, I think the essential words of the statute are what the jury found and what the Georgia Supreme Court has said, particularly in view of the Holton case where they just had depravity of mind. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Dunsmore?
Yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you. I'd like to make a couple of points that were raised during the questioning. On the Gregg case, the first point that I'd like to make is that we take the position very strongly that the Gregg case did not hold Section B-7 constitutional. There was a limiting footnote in that case, footnote number 51, that referred to the limited grant of certiorari in that case, which was limited to the question whether the death penalty in that case was unconstitutional. In that case, even though Section B-7 was charged, it was not found. The court, in responding to the arguments of counsel, that Section B-7 could apply to any murder. The court said in part, it is, of course, arguable that any murder involves depravity of mind or an aggravated battery. But this language need not be construed in this way, and there's no reason to assume that the Supreme Court of Georgia will adopt such an open-ended construction.
Where do you find that in Gregg? I have Gregg in front of me, and I'm...
That is 96 Supreme Court 2909 at 2938.
Oh, it's in the text, I see, page 201 U.S. Okay.
Just quoted in page 2122 of the brief. Footnote 51, I think, indicates that Section B-7 was considered in that case only to the extent to consider the attack against the entire system. So I don't believe the court has really decided that question, but this question is somewhat narrow because this question is limited to how the court, Supreme Court of Georgia, has construed Section B-7. And they have construed it, as conceded by the state, to really only include outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, and inhuman. And another case, I think the Blake versus State case, has said that outrageously and wantonly only modify vile, and they do not modify horrible and inhuman. And since the statute is couched in disjunctive terms, that means that a jury would be authorized to find the death penalty in Georgia on a finding that the murder was horrible. That's why we say that the open-ended construction that this court was not willing to assume that the Georgia Supreme Court would adopt has, in fact, been adopted. And the facts of this case, with reference in the brief to the 42 to 45 other domestic murder cases in Georgia that have been appealed, where life sentences were granted, of those, there has been no death penalty. Many of those cases, they're indicated in the brief, are similar on the facts to the this Godfrey case, including two or three multiple murders.
Well, suppose you look back over the history of the oversight of the sentencing by the Georgia Supreme Court, and you find that every single one, up until this one, when the seventh aggravating circumstances relied on, any guy in his right mind would think it was an outrageous crime, and it was really bad. And let's assume that you would agree that everyone but this one, until this one, the Georgia Supreme Court had applied the seventh aggravating circumstance in that way. Is that what you're suggesting they have? Until this one. Because you've just said there are an awful lot of them where they've had life sentences on facts like these.
Well, that's what the jury did. Mm-hmm. The Georgia Supreme Court, in no case, has found that the death penalty was not warranted on the facts, particularly under Section B-7.
Well, what if, following on Mr. Justice White's question, all of the cases affirming death penalties in Georgia under aggravating circumstances number 7 had been like McCorkadale, except this one.
Well, Your Honor, if they had been, I believe that I'd have to agree that that's included. The horrible torture murder is probably or necessarily what was intended to be reached. But because if you assume that they had all been that horrible and then this one comes along, really the Georgia Supreme Court has, under that hypothesis, never had an occasion yet to demonstrate how they did construe this section.
Until this one.
Until this one. This one shows that they construe it to indicate any first-degree murder where the jury has imposed the death sentence.
Has the prosecution carried its burden if it shows that the circumstances and facts of the particular case fit in any one of these categories?
You mean categories vile, horrible, or inhuman as separate categories?
Yeah. If the facts show that it fits any one of them, even though as a practical matter we know, probably I do, if it fits one, it's likely to fit more. But if it just fits one, does that not meet the prosecution's burden?
Your Honor, I would agree that if it fits one, it would fit all of them. And Blake versus State, that's really what the Georgia Supreme Court held.
And if it fits one, has the prosecution met its burden under the statute?
In theory, yes. In under this case, no. I don't. For one thing, I don't know how it could meet the burden of proving something, some murder was horrible beyond a reasonable doubt. It's completely subjective. You know.
Well, that may be. Any one of us might have that subjective reaction, but 12 presumably representative citizens of Georgia concluded that it did fit under at least one of these, did they not?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd have to assume that they did. The course of the Senate's review, in this case, the state has characterized this domestic murder in its brief as an execution-style murder. Now, they didn't dream up that separate category of murder. I believe not-for-profit execution-style murder is what they've called it. The Georgia Supreme Court did not mention that in the Godfrey case, but in another case, they created that category in order to uphold a Section B-7. So they have ignored the 45 domestic murder cases, although I have to say that the death penalty was not even sought in but 14 of those, and the jury did not find the death penalty.
But are you saying that a not-for-profit death by execution style murder couldn't fit within the language of Section 7?
I couldn't say that it couldn't fit, because our point is that any characterization of a first-degree murder could fit within Section B.
Well, are you saying that if the Georgia Supreme Court says a not-for-profit gangline execution-type killing fits, any first-degree murder fits, even though it's a clean rifle shot?
Oh, no, Your Honor. They have created this category, our point is, to in order to, under the statute, they have a duty under the statute to compare these death sentence cases with similar cases. And they have in the past said that will be determined by the what juries have done in similar cases in Georgia before. So they have ignored the category to which this properly belongs, domestic murders with a great deal of emotional and psychological diminished capacity, and taken it and put it into another category where they can compare it with 15 cases cited in the appendix and say that that's similar. They're using the similar word under the sentence review in a very elastic manner in order to uphold these Section B-7. And they don't compare Section B-7 cases with only other Section B-7 cases. In this case, there were only two of the 15 cited as similar that were Section B-7 only. The rest of them were B-2, rape, armed robbery, murders.
Your time has expired.
Mr. Holmes, you filed this this long list of summaries of other cases in which the death sentence was not imposed for one reason or another.
Yes.
In some of these cases, I noticed there was no authorization to impose a death sentence at the time of these convictions. For one reason or another, the death sentence was not imposed in these cases, summaries of which you filed, and there, I don't know how many of them.
I think there's 221.
200 and some. What's the argumentative purpose of this?
Well,
I'll be sure I understand.
I think Justice White pointed out in his concurrence in the Gregg case that in addition to the aggravating circumstance guidelines, there was the additional sentence review to be conducted by the Georgia Supreme Court, which would be an additional safeguard against capricious and arbitrary infliction of the death sentence.
Yes, that doesn't really answer my question.
They have construed their duty under that to compare it
with
to
other
all other cases
in which
life sentence cases appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court and other cases where the death sentence had been imposed, and compare those and then cite which cases they find to be similar in order to uphold the death sentence.
Right.
That's why I think those cases are relevant, because there are many of them in there that are very similar to Godfrey apparently ignored.
Were these all unappealed cases, I think?
Those are all life sentence cases that were appealed. Those are the only
these
ones.
These were appealed, weren't they?
The only ones that they consider are the ones that were appealed.
Right.
That discounts all those where prosecutors made a decision to allow a plea for a life sentence or
so
for voluntary
manslaughter. What is the point of this list? That's
your
point of view.
The point is that if the court were to feel that that the construction that we contend is open-ended on its face
right.
is somehow cured by the fact of the statutory sentence review, then this, we think, demonstrates that the statutory sentence review is not anything like was expected by this court in Gregg, and that they're not performing the duty that they're supposed to perform.
None of these was a death sentence?
None.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States.